Good morning, everyone. I'm Elaine Grace, the Deputy CEO of the Actuaries Institute. Our President, Jenny Lyon, was going to open proceedings, but unfortunately she's been unable to attend and sends her apologies. But we are lucky to have our incoming President in the audience, John Evans. Firstly, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Secondly, on behalf of the Actuaries Institute, I'd like to welcome you all today and acknowledge our sponsors for the session, PwC and Deloitte. Thank you for your support. I will shortly invite Jason Slade, convener of our Banking Practice Committee, to facilitate this session and formally welcome our speakers, Pat Brennan and Elliot Clark. But I want to especially thank Pat for stepping in at such short notice to represent APRA. Wayne Burrs was due to speak, but has been called overseas and has sent his sincere apologies. I note that the former Governor of the Bank of England, Lord Mervyn King, recently expressed concerns about the safety of the world banking system. That is a sobering observation, but I am comforted by the fact that Wayne is roaming the world troubleshooting for the international financial sector. Globally, APRA is one of the most highly regarded institutions, or highly regarded regulators, and we greatly appreciate the relationship that exists between us and the Institute. I want to publicly commend APRA for the constructive consultation regarding the recent review of the appointed actuary role. I think public policy development is much more effective when stakeholders engage in a spirit of genuine cooperation. So, Pat, thank you for upholding the APRA flag. We look forward to your address. I also want to commend Jason Slade and the Banking Practice Committee for organising today's event. I think we have over 180 attendees, either here or also we have significant numbers tuned in on the webinar. We hope to continue to build the Banking Actuaries Network with similar events in the future. And on that note, I'll hand over to Jason and encourage you all to enjoy and learn from today's discussion. Thank you.
So, good morning, everyone. And as Elaine said, I'm Jason Slade. I'm current convener of the Banking Practice Committee. And look, I'd like to just echo Elaine's comments. Welcome, everyone. And it's just fantastic to see so many people here and so many young faces in particular. I mean, I thought with the part three exams, the results coming out today, it might be a little bit of a lower attendance. So if anyone passed the exams, and particularly those who qualified, congratulations. And we can all relate to that day. So look, we on the Banking Practice Committee, we're very excited about the future of the actuarial profession in the banking sector. We think there's a lot of opportunity for us. Risk consciousness is as high on the agenda as it's ever been. Stakeholders everywhere are wanting to know answers, you know, what if, how much exposure have we got, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. And we think the actuarial fundamental skill set of dealing with uncertainty, measuring risk, managing risk, that positions the actuarial profession to do really, really well in the banking sector. And we think that we can add a lot of value, and we think we need to really sort of grow our voice in this market. You know, from things like credit risk to interest rate risk to liquidity to capital management, balance sheet management, stress testing, all of those things, there's strong parallels to the insurance industry where the actuarial profession already has a strong voice. We need to be doing just the same in the banking profession. So we're very optimistic that there's a big and growing role for actuaries going forward in the banking sector. Now, we're delighted today to have two top draw speakers for you. We've got Pat Brennan from APRA, who I'll introduce more fully in a second, and Elliot Clark from Westpac. The format will be that Pat will give 20 or so minutes on some policy developments from APRA, and then we'll have a 10-15 minute Q&A. And then we'll hear from Elliot, and again, another sort of 10-15 minute Q&A. And then at the end, we'll have some refreshments. And I encourage everyone to stay around, talk to someone you haven't met before. The whole purpose of these sort of sessions is around networking. It's around creating a stronger community where we talk to each other, we share perspectives, we learn from each other. That's what being a profession is all about. So I encourage everyone to stay around at the end. So look, without further ado, I'll introduce Patrick Brennan. Pat's EGM policy and advice at APRA and started in that role in July 2016. His responsibilities include the policy agenda, resolution function, and new entrant licensing. Patrick joined APRA in 2011 to lead its specialist credit and operational risk teams, and from 2014 has led policy development. Prior to joining APRA, Pat spent 25 years working in the banking industry, covering a range of financial markets and treasury roles in Australia, New Zealand, and London. Pat has a Master of Applied Finance from Macquarie, and he also completed the Executive Fellows Program at the Australian New Zealand School of Government. So welcome, Pat.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity for APRA to be part of today's event. Most people in this room would know well that the Bayle Committee on Banking Supervision released a package of reforms in 2010 to promote a more resilient global banking system. The package is widely known as Bayle 3. Most would also know that the Bayle 3 package encompassed strengthening capital requirements for the banking industry. Quite a number of you would also be aware that Bayle 3 included the first global standards on liquidity and funding. I suspect few, however, when asked about the list of components of Basel III, would list the introduction of the first internationally agreed macroprudential tool. That tool is the countercyclical capital buffer, which aims to build capital buffers that can be used to protect the banking system, and therefore the broader economy, from periods of excess credit growth. The countercyclical capital buffer was introduced into the Australian capital standards for banks and otherwise authorised deposit-taking institutions through our Prudential Standards APS 110 Capital Adequacy. The buffer came into effect from January 2016. It applies to all Australian ADIs, as well as, via reciprocity provisions that I'll say more about shortly, it also applies to the Australian exposures of foreign banks that operate here. Thus far, APRA has not used the countercyclical capital buffer in response to risks within the banking system, though that does not mean we would never plan to do so. Today I will recap how the countercyclical framework works and outline the current trends that influence our thinking on likely future use. One of the lessons from the financial crisis was that losses incurred by the banks following periods of excess credit growth can be extremely large. And as a result, there are several interrelated objectives of the countercyclical capital buffer. Firstly, raising capital resilience when there is judged to be a build-up of systemic risk. Secondly, moderating the cycle of credit growth and asset prices through raising capital requirements during an upswing. The increase in capital requirements may provide an incentive for banks to temper credit growth and raise the cost of credit to dampen demand. And thirdly, improving the flow of credit during a downturn, thereby supporting the real economy through the reduction of the buffer and therefore the capital requirements in periods of stress. The release of the buffer requirements should alleviate pressures that may otherwise arise, that banks may feel pressured to reduce balance sheet growth to meet capital requirements, and therefore releasing the buffer should continue to support the continued provision of credit to the economy. In short, the countercyclical capital buffer provides a tool that can be used to raise banking sector capital requirements in periods of excess credit growth associated with the build-up of systemic risk. This additional buffer can then be released during periods of stress to reduce the risk that the supply of credit is hindered by regulatory capital requirements. Decisions on when to increase or decrease the countercyclical capital buffer are complex judgments and involve an assessment of whether and to what degree there is excessive credit growth and rising systemic risk. APRA's overall approach to setting the level of buffer in Australia was set out in an information paper that we released in late 2015, along with the announcement that the initial setting of the buffer would be 0%. In that paper, we indicated that our decisions regarding the buffer would be based on forward-looking judgments informed by a set of core indicators of systemic risk. These core indicators include the credit to GDP guide recommended by the Basel Committee, in addition to other indicators of systemic risk associated with the financial cycle. Importantly, we made it clear that the countercyclical buffer would not be based on a mechanical formula, but rather a broader assessment of credit conditions. The primary indicators that we flagged are just that, indicators. By themselves, they're not determinative. Broadly speaking, we said that decisions to increase the buffer would be based on an assessment of whether credit growth is excessive, asset price growth is unsustainable, and/or lending conditions are loose. Decisions to decrease or release the buffer would be informed by a reversal of those trends and evidence of the emergence of financial stress. We also indicated that we would monitor and assess a range of core indicators to support judgments on the level of the buffer, in addition to other data, information and market intelligence. Given the potential broader implications for financial stability, APRA routinely seeks the counsel of the other members of the Council of Financial Regulators as part of our decision-making process. A key aspect of the countercyclical buffer framework is transparency. The Basel framework requires that the relevant authority, in Australia that is APRA, publish at least annually a summary of the indicators they are monitoring and a rationale for their determination on the appropriate level of the buffer. This promotes not just accountability for the regulator, but also a deeper understanding among industry participants as to how decisions are made, including how they may be better anticipated and planned for in advance. We have published our 2017 assessment today, and I will talk through some of the highlights and overview this morning. Before I do, however, I'd just like to remind you how the countercyclical buffer actually works. First, the buffer can be set between 0 and a maximum of 2.5% of risk-weighted assets. In other words, it can be used to add up to an additional 2.5% to existing capital requirements. For example, for an ADI that normally is faced with a minimum Common Equity Tier 1 requirement of 7%, if the countercyclical buffer was switched on in full, would have to manage to a minimum capital requirement of 9.5%. The countercyclical capital buffer operates as an extension to the capital conservation range. ADIs that do not maintain their capital levels above the level of the conservation range have their dividend payments and other distributions increasingly restricted. The capital conservation range is typically set at 2.5%, meaning that the countercyclical buffer could, again, if switched on in full, potentially see that range doubled, effectively encourage banks to increase their levels of capital to avoid encountering the restrictions I mentioned. An interesting aspect of this buffer are the arrangements for international reciprocity. Normally, regulators set regulations for their jurisdiction, and these do not affect banks operating in other jurisdictions. In the case of the countercyclical capital buffer, however, APRA's decisions may affect the capital requirements of non-Australian banks, and the decisions of our peer regulators may affect the capital requirements of Australian banks. The total countercyclical capital buffer that an ADI is required to hold reflects both the level of the Australian jurisdictional buffer applied to Australian exposures and any buffer requirements in effect in other jurisdictions to which the ADI also has exposures. So when, as is the case now, the UK authorities decide to apply the countercyclical buffer to UK exposures, that decision applies to the UK exposures of Australian ADIs as well. These international arrangements are designed to ensure a level playing field between domestic and foreign banks with respect to the countercyclical capital buffers across jurisdictions. For Australian ADIs, the buffer set by APRA will dominate the buffer calculation purely due to the weight of exposures. However, Australian ADIs with international exposures also need to monitor countercyclical capital buffers set by other authorities in varying jurisdictions, in basically wherever they do business. To provide a foundation to the countercyclical capital buffer framework, the Basel Committee developed a common reference guide based on the aggregate private sector credit to GDP gap. The credit to GDP gap is the difference between the ratio of credit to GDP and its long-term trend. A positive gap, that is, a level above trend, is potentially indicative of excessive credit growth. The Basel Committee recommended that the credit to GDP guide should be considered as a starting reference point, but the relevant authorities could also use judgment and other relevant indicators in setting the countercyclical capital buffer in their jurisdiction. Few, if any, jurisdictions have chosen to rely on credit to GDP gap alone. Most, like APRA, have selected a range of metrics that are most relevant for local market conditions. This has included evaluating indicators that have provided strong signals of excess credit growth and rising systemic risk during previous financial cycles, for example, the pre-financial crisis period of the early 2000s. As a result, APRA has adopted an approach that is firstly informed by a target set of core indicators of systemic risk, is secondly judgment-based with a strong weight placed on the analysis and assessment of indicators rather than on mechanical triggers, and thirdly is forward-looking based on early warning indicators during the risk build-up phase to allow time for changes to ADI capital levels to be implemented and on timely indicators of stress to enable a quick release of requirements during a downturn. As the foundation of its countercyclical capital buffer framework, APRA chose 9 core indicators that are well understood and generally publicly available. They're relevant and representative of the risks concerned. These are credit growth indicators, specifically the credit to GDP gap, housing credit growth, and business credit growth. We look at asset prices, housing pricing growth, and commercial property price growth. We look at lending indicators, specifically higher risk residential mortgage lending, business lending conditions, and loan pricing and margins. And we also look at signs of financial stress in the form of non-performing loans. While the core indicators provide a strong signal on the direction of systemic risk, as I noted, they do not translate formulaically into decisions on the level of the buffer. To understand the reasons for movements in these indicators, APRA monitors a wide range of supplementary metrics and other data, including subsegments and more granular data. Other factors would also be important in this decision, including assessment of current bank capital positions, prudential concerns, and the overall economic outlook. APRA also considers findings and trends arising from its supervisory activities, involving individual regulated institutions where that's relevant. And, as I noted, we're also guided by the views of other members of the Council of Financial Regulators. APRA assesses each of the above indicator areas individually and as a group, together with other relevant information on a quarterly basis to arrive at an overall view of the degree of concern with respect to a build-up of systemic risk. As I noted, we originally set the countercyclical buffer at zero at the end of 2015, noting that notwithstanding strong credit growth into housing, there was little to suggest excessive growth across the Australian economy more broadly. So what do current trends show? Firstly, credit growth. The Basel Committee suggested that authorities should consider the use of the countercyclical capital buffer if the credit to GDP gap rose above 2%. In Australia, the credit to GDP gap has been negative for some time. With the recent moderation in housing lending growth, the gap is expected to remain negative for some time yet. At a more granular level, housing investor growth has shown signs of a pickup over the last 12 months, but with growth moderated slightly over the September quarter. Forward-looking indicators suggest this moderation will likely continue in the months ahead. More broadly, total housing growth has been little changed, as the moderation in investor credit has been offset by stronger growth in the owner-occupied credit. This trend is reflective of a recent widening in differential pricing between the two products in response to regulatory interventions. Growth in credit is expected to be supported in the near term by, among other things, the settlement of a significant supply of apartments due to hit the market in the eastern capital cities in the coming months. However, working in the other direction is the impact of higher home loan rates and tighter lending standards, which may see some marginal borrowers find it more difficult to access credit, particularly for investor and interest-only products. Business credit growth strengthened slightly over the September quarter, following slower growth earlier in the year. However, business credit growth remains below recent mid-2016 peaks and relatively modest overall. Looking ahead, quarterly and six-monthly annualised growth rates suggest that business credit growth may strengthen gradually in the near term. Survey-based measures support this prognosis, suggesting that both business confidence and conditions have continued to strengthen over the past year. Domestic ADIs have also reduced their exposure limits to commercial property, consistent with the tightening in lending standards, particularly for residential developments. Growth in commercial property lending exposures reduced slightly over September quarter. On to asset prices. Housing market conditions continue to vary greatly across the country, but have generally eased in recent months. While measures of annual price growth remain well above long-run averages, more recently, housing price growth has slowed in pace, particularly in the Sydney market. Nationally, six-month-ended annualised growth has slowed to less than half that of recent peaks, influenced by APRA's benchmark on interest-only lending, increased housing supply, and higher interest rates for some borrowers. Price growth in housing assets also continues to differ by asset type. At a national level, apartment prices continue to be outpriced by price growth of detached houses, reflecting the increased relative supply of apartments. However, the gap in price growth by housing type has begun to narrow, as elevated price growth in detached housing falls back in line with that of apartments. Commercial property price growth, however, remains significant. Growth in Australian commercial asset prices continued to accelerate rapidly over the September quarter. While rapid growth in CBD office prices was supported by similar growth in rents, growth in industrial and retail asset prices continued to greatly outprice growth in rents over the quarter. Six-month-ended annualised price growth was slightly lower than annual rates for non-residential commercial property in September, suggesting price growth may soften somewhat in the coming months. Results from APRA's commercial property data analysis and survey of credit conditions and lending standards suggest that underwriting standards have broadly improved, particularly with respect to loan sizes relative to valuations and costs, and minimum pre-sale requirements. Moving on to lending conditions. At an industry level, shares of higher risk mortgage lending continued to moderate over the September quarter. Shares of new lending written on interest-only terms further declined, particularly for investor lending. A sharp decline in approvals data suggests that interest-only lending will further decline in the months ahead. ADIs have also generally revised lending standards to accord with APRA's expectations for high LVR interest-only lending. These revisions have begun to flow through to lower shares of high LVR interest-only lending. The total stock of interest-only loans on ADI's books has declined in recent months, consistent with the incentive for existing customers to switch to cheaper principal and interest repayments. Upwards repricing has also seen investor lending continue to moderate to be comfortably within APRA's 10% benchmark. However, the share of loans in the high loan-to-income ratios, that's above 6 times, ticked up slightly over the September quarter, and loans approved with a relatively low net income surplus remain quite high. Recent lending conditions appear to have been largely unchanged in the corporate and SME sectors. NAB's survey of business confidence suggests that confidence and conditions have remained strong over the September quarter and are well above long-run averages. However, in feedback to APRA on credit conditions and lending standards, banks have reported that overall demand remains largely subdued. Consequently, limited growth opportunities in these sectors may create competitive pressures, placing continued pressure on lending standards. For commercial real estate lending, standards have continued to tighten amid concerns of oversupply and heightened settlement risk in some regions. In particular, some banks noted a tightening of maximum loan-to-valuation ratios for both development and investment lending, consistent with a rapid growth in asset prices. Banks also reported tightening in minimum pre-sale requirements and minimum interest coverage ratios. While the peak of apartment supply is yet to come, banks reported that settlement failures are in line with historical norms. However, some banks have noted that settlement delays have become more prominent, consistent with some purchasers finding it more difficult to secure retail funding. Although not evident in the data, banks continue to expect credit quality to deteriorate for commercial real estate, particularly for development and retail investment lending. And on to asset quality. Non-performing loans are one indicator, albeit lagging, of realised financial stress. The overall share of non-performing loans remain near its post-crisis low, at a little under 1% of lending. That said, There were ongoing divergences in loan performance by region and asset type. Over the September quarter, higher arrears on housing and personal lending persisted in regions and sectors with exposures to mining, with reported arrears on personal loans further affected by changes in banks' hardship reporting. In contrast, the low interest rate environment continues to support credit quality in the commercial real estate sector and other business sectors. APRA's current assessment. Bringing these various considerations together, as I said earlier, inevitably is a matter of judgment. We have concluded that there is not a case at this stage to apply a non-zero countercyclical capital buffer. Broadly speaking, the credit to GDP ratio is well below its longer-term trend, and credit growth indicators are currently showing some signs of softening. High-risk lending for both residential and commercial property is being reduced, and impaired assets are, overall, at modest levels. Most of these indicators are flat or tending to indicate lower risk over the most recent quarter. Most are also indicating a moderation in risk since APRA's original decision in late 2015. On the other hand, trends in property prices have been signalling heightened risk for some time. On their own, however, they do not suggest the need to institute the countercyclical capital buffer at this point. Rather, APRA has chosen to tackle these risks with other tools. In housing lending, this includes our benchmarks on investor and interest-only lending, as well as substantial supervisory work to improve serviceability standards. APRA has also conducted a thematic review on commercial property lending and has communicated the key areas for improvement to the industry. That said, as I noted to begin with, the countercyclical capital buffer is designed to reinforce the resilience of the banking system in response to excessive credit growth. Certainly, credit growth has been a key factor in our supervisory concerns in relation to housing, but ultimately we decided not to use the countercyclical capital buffer for housing risks thus far because the risks we were responding to could be better addressed, in our view, with more targeted measures aimed at improving credit underwriting practices and targeting capital increases specifically to mortgage lending. Also, we were already building up capital in the banking system via the unquestionably strong and mortgage risk rate recommendations of the Financial System Inquiry, which were being implemented in parallel, and we did not see the need to apply a broad brush capital increase that would impact the provision of non-housing credit. If, however, we got to the point where credit was deemed to be growing excessively despite the establishment of strong credit standards, then we may well be in an environment in which the countercyclical capital buffer is designed to be used. Our judgment as of today, however, is that we are not at that point and other tools are working more effectively. So in summary, Basel III brought with it the first internationally agreed macroprudential tool in the form of the countercyclical capital buffer. The buffer is available to be used at times when credit growth is excessive, with a view to building up additional resilience in the banking system. In simple terms, this can be thought of putting a little bit extra away for a rainy day. In Australia, the countercyclical buffer has not been used to date. It is thus far a new and unused tool in our toolkit. We have not used it so far because we feel the risk to stability in the banking system can be dealt with through a range of other tools available to us. In the case of housing, where there has been most supervisory attention, we think it far better to tackle loose lending standards directly rather than simply tolerate them and require more capital instead. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat. So you heard it here first. There's no change to the countercyclical capital buffer just yet. Has anyone got any questions? We've got a few from the webinar. I'll just remind viewers that if anyone does have any questions, they can log those in and I'll read them out. But before I get to any of those, is there anyone here got any questions they'd like to put to Pat? Just while everyone's thinking, I've got a couple here that I'll just get you started with. And but these came out a bit early in your talk, so you did sort of touch on these a little bit, Pat. But somebody was asking that with credit growth, yes, it may have come off a bit to GDP in recent times, but the long trajectory has been that it's outstripped GDP growth. So, does that matter? And
If not, why not?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So the gap is negative, but credit to GDP is high. I think that's the core of the issue. That's something we're watching very closely, but clearly that is a very broad macroeconomic consideration. So we are really targeting signs of excessive growth, signs of systemic risk, and at this point they're not increasing. So in that environment, we're not switching on the buffer. But for all sectors of the industry, you know, governments focus on it, regulators focus on it, hopefully industries focus on it. We are at the sort of internationally the dizzy heights of that ratio, along with very few other countries. Saying that, we have a slightly different economic structure. There are some reasons why it may be justified that it's elevated. There's something we need to continue to watch. The near-term signs, though, are positive.
Yeah, thanks, Pat. Now, another question, similar theme. So you mentioned the benchmarking around investor lending and investment lending in the mortgage space. Seems to be working. Any indications as to whether that might be reduced anytime soon?
Well, with the interest-only benchmark, it certainly seems to have worked quite well. There's been a significant shift, but it's still very new. So that was introduced in a letter we released in March. So we'd like to see that sort of embedded. On investor lending, in fact, both these measures, we've always said they're intended to be temporary. They're not permanent parts of the framework. If there is further moderation, if there is a genuine and embedded improvement in lending standards, then that would be helpful. And also looking into next year, we've also already publicly stated we're going to review the capital framework and some of the concepts of higher risk residential mortgage lending, which have been such in focus for APRA, will be reflected in the capital framework. With all those things in place, that there may be a case to move away from the benchmarks, but we've got to see how things pan out.
Yeah, be too early yet, by the sounds of it. Anyone got any questions? And can you just, I should have said, before you start, can you just announce yourself and where you're from?
Hi, you. I'm Paul Rahill from ANZ. I work in a wealth area. Pat, I'm interested in, does APRA track the loan-to-value ratio across, say, calendar year for the banks? Like, it'll be obviously higher, maybe 95% around 2017, maybe 60% a number of years ago, all the way down to zero. Because that'd be useful information, because if house prices do retract 10 or 20 or 30%, and you know the amount of loans in each of those calendar years, you can look for stress points. Is that sort of information publicly available?
But we do have data which is both by approvals and by loan drawdowns and the overall portfolio. A lot of that is published, not just by us, but the Reserve Bank has a lot of data which is available. So yes, there is publicly available information. It's certainly something we track.
Eric Granson from NatEquity. Excuse me. You alluded to releasing capital in a crisis. Does where the current capital levels on the countercyclical capital buffer is zero, is there still plenty of scope to release capital?
My comment was specifically on the countercyclical buffer. So the idea is to remove it and remove it very quickly if it has been switched on and things turn around. Just to make it clear, the general concept of the countercyclical buffer is when it's switched on, it should take effect within a year. When it's removed, it's removed immediately. In terms of other capital requirements, there is a minimum capital requirement, which we do not intend to provide any flexibility on. That's the whole point of having a minimum capital requirement. Remember, there is the capital conservation buffer. So that's 2.5%, which is designed to be a buffer that whilst, as I said in the prepared comments, does come with distribution constraints, which banks may not want to deal with. They might want to stay above the buffer. It is designed to give at least a temporary cushion should adversity, for example, come on quickly.
Thanks.
And
David Tu from Westpac. Question on a slightly different topic. The press is reporting Basel will release RWA reform package probably tonight or tomorrow morning. I assume that's where Wayne is. A couple of questions. Firstly, can you confirm that? Secondly, is there anything you can share around, are there any major deviations or changes from your expectations when you released your July unquestionably strong paper? And thirdly, should we still expect your next consultation this side of Christmas?
So progress towards finalising Basel III has been slow and steady for a very long time, as you would know. Whether an agreement is reached prior to Christmas or not, I wouldn't like to put a public statement speculating on that. If it is finalised, it would be very welcome. But for the Australian industry, APRA's announcement earlier this year on unquestionably strong is probably more significant because that sets the overall capital requirements, and frankly, nothing coming out of Basel will cause that to increase or for that matter decrease. So the target's pretty clear already. What we'll be consulting on are the various components that add up to that target. And again, our focus on high-risk residential mortgage lending is on the record, so that's what industry will be most interested in when we come to consult on it. Given the continued progress in Basel, there is an increase in likelihood that our next consultation will be early next year, not this year. It would be, I think, slightly unhelpful for us to put out a consultation package which is quickly followed by an announcement from Basel. That would be too sort of perhaps too much to deal with in one go, and you'd need to read both to get the complete picture.
Thank you.
So just on that, Pat, and just for the avoidance of doubt, this July position of unquestionably strong, and we think that the level is set right. So if there were to be a change in the RWAs associated with mortgage lending, are you saying that it would be offset by a reduction elsewhere?
Well, there's two things. There's whether there's changes in the Basel framework, and clearly there's an updated framework, so there's changes from what's existing in place, and then there's what APRA does to implement them. Remember the starting position that in Australia we have quite conservative capital levels already internationally, and we've actually set a benchmark that makes them even more conservative. So if you think of the components, Basel will not be coming up with requirements which are more conservative, so the target is already set. In terms of what then APRA does to reflect higher risk mortgage lending and other things in the capital framework, again, that's about the components. The quantum of capital is set. So for any IRB bank that hits the 10.5% CET1 ratio, for a standardised bank that can accommodate a 50 basis point increase in the underlying requirements, no matter what we do to the components, they should be on the sound footing.
Thanks, Pat. Now, look, we promised Pat we'd get him out of here by 10:45, so we've got time for one more quick question. So, Paul?
Paul Nuttall, CBA. Just going back to the countercyclical buffer and the comparison with the UK, with the PRA introducing one over there. Can you just comment about the sort of level of risk that you see in the UK system compared to Australia, or is it more of a methodology difference?
It's somewhat a methodology difference. The UK has said that they have a preference to have the countercyclical buffer on at, at the highest point, but have a positive number in normal times. So that's quite a different approach. I won't make any comment on systemic risk in the UK relative to Australia. Whilst I'm from the UK, it's been a long time. But the fact that they've switched the buffer on, I think, reflects a sort of a broad regulatory position, perhaps more than something's happened recently to elevate a lot of risk.
Okay, well, thanks, Pat. Just join me in. Join me in. Thank you, Pat, for this time. We're just going to give Pat a small gift, but they're just organising it. So next up, we've got Elliot Clark. Elliot's a senior economist at Westpac. He's been there for 8 years. He previously worked at the RBA, analysing developments in Asia and global financial markets. At Westpac, he's responsible for the team's analysis of the US, Europe and China, as well as developments in international capital flows and financial markets. Elliot holds an honours degree in economics and econometrics from the University of Sydney, a Masters of Applied Finance from Macquarie, and he's also a CFA charter holder and a member of the CFA Society of Sydney. So welcome, Elliot.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you today to talk about our outlook for the Australian economy and to sort of think a bit about the global economy as well. It's also quite a fitting time to do this because we've had two particular key releases this week, being the RBA's final meeting statement, which came out on Tuesday, and equally then we had GDP for the September quarter as well released yesterday. The reason why I say they're quite important releases is the first, starting with the RBA, this was a statement which very clearly emphasised that they are firmly on hold at the moment. This is despite them remaining quite optimistic about where 2018 might take us, and they still expect growth will actually move back up towards a trend or above, indeed, in 2018. But at the moment, the uncertainties that are around, particularly the consumer, are meaning that they are sort of waiting and just watching and seeing what happens. And now if we switch across to GDP for the September quarter, the reason why that is quite important because it really emphasises these kind of risks and these uncertainties that they actually do see in the economy, and indeed we do as well, very clearly. So we had growth of about 2.8% for the year. But what was really important about this release was the weakness we saw in the consumer. So the consumption actually rose by only 0.1 in the quarter, which meant that annual growth was about 2.2%. To put that into perspective, if we're talking about the pre-GFC environment, we used to have consumption growth of about 3.5%. Even in the post-GFC environment, we've been running at about 2.6. So that 2.2 is a very weak outcome, and it's very difficult to see growth at trend, let alone above trend, on that kind of proviso. Equally, sort of some of the other sort of detail we saw in the survey, some parts are optimistic, but some parts are negative. It really emphasised that the residential investment boom, which we've been seeing in recent years, which has been a significant contributor to growth, and we'll talk a bit more about that later, is really now turned and is actually taking away from growth. And we actually saw that with renovation work as well. That's fallen away as well. But business investment is a more positive for the economy. We've had a very long period where mining investment has been a significant negative for the economy. That's really coming away and getting back towards about a zero contribution to growth. Equally, we're starting to see non-mining investment actually starting to get a bit more momentum and accelerate away. But what's really important to highlight there is that much of this business investment really depends on the consumer. So if you continue to see a weak consumer, then it's really hard to get above trend growth in business investment. So what I wanted to do today is, I guess, sort of lean on a number of those kind of insights we've seen on these two releases and talk in particular about the significance of confidence in this economy and how that's kind of evolved over the last kind of decade or so following the GFC. We've seen quite a significant change with central banks sort of moving from trying to instill confidence in the economy by reining in inflation to now trying to promote growth. This is quite a different scenario, and it's really sort of plays itself out across the global economy, albeit for different reasons. We'll then move on and think a bit more about the cautious consumer, what that means for residential housing, and also what it means for consumption growth and therefore the economy. Following on from that, we'll touch again on macroprudential policy's impact on the real estate sector, and also think about a little bit about what's happening within foreign buyers and their implications for house prices as well. Moving on from there, we'll think a little bit more about the more positive elements of the Australian economy at the moment, particularly around business investment and also public infrastructure. And then move on to think a little bit more broadly, globally, about investment as well, thinking about the implications for investment from the financial markets perspective and people's expectations, I suppose, about sort of what fiscal policy might mean for the global economy as well going forward. After all of that, we'll draw back to think about what the Australian dollar is likely to do over the next year or so and draw out the implications of that for the Australian economy and for the RBA. So just let us start with a bit of perspective, which is thinking back over the last kind of 20 to 30 years and this kind of shift we've seen from central banks thinking about trying to promote confidence in the economy by pulling back inflation and making sure that it met their sort of target following on very high levels of inflation we saw through the 90s. That was obviously very much was their focus all the way until I think I left the RBA 8 or so years ago. It was always the expectation that, if anything, inflation would be sort of getting away from us a bit, and we needed to be very cautious in our action and look to try and make sure that didn't happen. So that meant higher rates on average and trying to maintain that or rein in the economy and not see it overheat and grow too quickly above potential. Now, obviously, we had the GFC, and that changed a lot in the world, but most notably from a central bank's perspective has been that we've really lost inflation. We've moved from a situation where we were talking about inflation being an excessive target to risks around deflation in sort of 2015, 2016, and now we've moved back to this kind of disinflationary environment where inflation is kind of getting towards target, but it's not quite good enough to really justify rate increases as it has done in the past. There's a number of different examples of this around the world. You can think about the US, where although they have been increasing interest rates, they haven't really been able to do that as they might quickly as they might have expected, despite the unemployment rate coming all the way down to 4.1% and full employment being seen there. Equally, in Europe, they're struggling to get inflation sort of meaningfully above 1% on a core basis, which really means that they are it's very difficult for them to actually think about pulling back on alternative measures of policy accommodation, let alone actually thinking about raising rates. And we've even had the very interesting circumstance in the UK where they have raised rates, but they've done so in the hope that they will actually sort of try and improve sort of real wages and limit the inflation that's come from the sort of the Brexit shock and the depreciation in the sterling. It's not really coming from some homegrown inflationary pressures. It's more of a sort of financial markets impact. So with all of that, that really highlights as to why we've seen a situation with the RBA remaining on hold for a long period of time here, that we just really haven't been able to get sort of inflation back towards the 2-3% target band. And this is really our expectation going forward, is that it's very unlikely that we'll see inflation move meaningfully above that bottom end of that target range. It's more likely to sort of sit around that 2% figure. Very strongly related to what we're seeing with inflation is the outlook for wages. Now, this is just a sort of a simple representation of where we see wages growth across the world. You can note that for countries which have full employment at the moment, so the US and UK being good examples there, they still aren't able to actually see wages growth at or above the long-run average levels. So there's something fundamental happening here that is meaning that price pressures, both in wages and inflation, are really being restricted and not sort of acting as we would have thought they would have in the past. Equally, for a country like Australia, I mean, obviously we didn't have the impact of the GFC as much as a number of the other countries around the world, but we have had a number of years of softer growth, below trend, and that so part of the story is why we have weak wages there. It is part of that narrative, and equally the mining sector going through the change that has gone through, the wages there are much lower, and there's a lot less people employed in that sector, so that's part of the story as well. But for a country like Australia, what we see is these weak wage pressures are very broad-based across the economy. And we've effectively got most of the sectors now at sort of historically low levels on the wage price index. And if we sort of think more broadly and think about income measures out of the national accounts, they're at historic lows, and we've got sort of real wages or real income growth basically flat or a little bit higher over the year, which is a very difficult situation for the consumer to be in terms of trying to stoke growth in consumption and also in residential investment. So just thinking about that a little bit more for Australia, so this is part of the reason really is that the sort of measures we have for unemployment really don't give a full description as to where the labour market is at. We tend to like to sort of favour this view on underemployment as well to try and give a sense of the degree of slack in an economy. And what's really showing in particular is there's a lot of people out there who can't get the amount of work they would actually like to receive. So people who are working part-time because they can't get a full-time job. There's also been quite a significant shift in terms of the industries in which employment growth has actually occurred. So generally we've seen a lot of jobs being created in lower income professions rather than those higher income ones we haven't seen in the past. This is partly the mining story pulling through, so not many jobs being created there. But equally, we're seeing quite a significant shift in terms of professional services, where there's a definite need for efficiency and a drive for that. And that has meant that we've had quite a few people actually choose to leave where they are employed and actually exit the labour force, which means they're not actually participating and therefore they're not counted in the unemployment rate. Now, whether they actually are going into retirement or whether they will come back, we don't necessarily know at this stage. But it does mean that we're, in terms of understanding where wages are at and where they're likely to go going forward, we need to consider that this kind of extra degree of slack, which the unemployment rate doesn't really show. So the combination of weak wages growth on sort of an hourly basis or in terms of year to year, equally this kind of shift we're seeing in terms of sort of lower income jobs being kind of in the ascendancy and the higher income jobs dissipating, has really meant that despite seeing employment growth as kind of 3% or so over the last year, that households have still remained very, very cautious. You see this in terms of their expectations around their family finances. So I've got here the, over the next 12 months, but equally it's quite true as to where people see themselves from a year ago as well. They just don't feel particularly confident in where their incomes are going and therefore their willingness to actually go out and spend on additional items for their household. And this is, you can quite clearly see here, been a longer term trend we've seen. It's not just the last 6 months, but it's more like the last 5 to 7 years that have been this way. This is kind of one of the sort of areas we really try to highlight to our customer base, is that this is exactly why we're not seeing that sort of pick up in consumption growth that many people have been expected, including the RBA. The other point to note about this is it's not just about sort of where income levels are at, it's also about the, I guess, the shocks that are coming into people's household budgets as well. And one of the most significant of those has been what we've seen in terms of electricity prices. So this is just showing Sydney electricity prices, but it's been a very similar story across the nation, that the combination of quite limited investment in the sector, quite strong population growth, which has led to a greater demand for electricity, and also just the increased use of technology and all the different things we have in life now, has meant that people's sort of electricity bills and other essential services bills have increased quite dramatically. This has been much more about price than sort of their sort of, I guess, total use of actual volume of electricity, but it still has had a very significant impact. So if you get in a situation where you've got life essentials rising at quite a rapid clip, well in excess of inflation, but equally your income is actually struggling to keep up with inflation, it's not then surprising that you have some concerns about your family finances. The other point to note is that household debt, as was discussed by Pat, in terms of a level sense, relative to the economy, is at very high levels. I think we are second only to Switzerland in terms of our sort of credit to GDP, which obviously is being very much driven by the household sector. And it's not a systematic sort of concern in terms of thinking about leading to a potential sort of collapse in housing or those kind of things, but it is a very significant weight on the economy, and one, again, which is limiting people's willingness to go out and spend. As we've sort of seen, I guess, in the recent past, this is sort of a situation where even though we have seen rate cuts on a number of bases over the last couple of years, I guess interest costs to the households have generally sort of remained or held at a similar level because we have seen this continual rise in debt. So you sort of, in terms of the total dollars that have been paid out, it's a very similar amount. And there's been, I guess, an additional sort of factor which has played into it recently, and I might come back to this in a sec, but with regards to the changes we've seen with macroprudential policy, that those who have been running on an interest-only loan have now found themselves paying a higher interest rate. This is applicable not only to to investors, but also to owner-occupiers as well. And we'll talk a bit more about macroprudential in a second, but I just want to pop back to the slide for a second as well. Quite often it's spoken about that sort of we have very high levels of debt, but equally we have a lot of deposits and a lot of other wealth. And this is absolutely true, but with regards to the consumer, the reality is that a lot of this wealth is actually structured sort of in sort of not particularly liquid like a state. So you don't really go out and pull a brick out of the wall of your house to go and pay for the milk down at the milk bar. And the implication of this is that, yes, we have very strong growth in wealth over the last 5 or so years, both house prices and equities, but people aren't looking to tap that. Equally, if you just look at the red line here, which has on this graph, which is accumulated savings, it's also not the case that the people who have the savings are equally the people who have the debt. So we do have data on offset accounts relative to total deposits, and we know that's a small fraction. A lot of the deposits are being held by people who are getting close to retirement, and they're held for a purpose, which is to actually pay for their retirement going forward. And that's the same for superannuation assets and equities and all those kind of things as well. So we can't rely on this wealth being used to drive above trend growth in consumption going forward. So just getting back to macroprudential policy, the changes that have been made are quite significant, and they have had a very major impact on markets. And we'll talk about house prices as an example in a minute. But what I also want to highlight is it's a very beneficial step for the economy in the sense that it has meant the RBA could actually remain on hold. They haven't had to use their very blunt instrument of the cash rate to actually try and rein in the housing market. They've been able to rely on macroprudential to do that instead. And that's actually meant that we've been able to keep the cash rate at 1.5% and for the RBA to remain, I guess, willing to think about sort of potentially cutting that if they actually need to going forward if growth disappoints materially and the labour market deteriorates. That's not the situation we're in currently, but they do have that option going forward. And they could be able to do that without losing confidence that they would lose control of the housing market because of the way in which macroprudential policy has been shown to be effective in terms of mitigating, I guess, the speculation that has happened in the housing market and the potential excesses that could build up from where we currently reside. The best example, I suppose, of the impact of macroprudential is on housing prices themselves. And this is showing, I guess, to really emphasise the six-month annualised growth in house prices. So this isn't necessarily the actual rate of change you might see in house prices in a particular time because we've annualised it, but it does really give effect of the volatility we're seeing in prices. And you see, both in 2015 and also in 2017, which are the two time periods where we've seen macroprudential be brought into effect, that we have had a very significant slowing in housing market activity. And what's important to note here as well is that it's been concentrated in the areas where we've seen the most, I guess, exuberance in markets or in speculation by investors, being Sydney and Melbourne. The other capitals haven't been as impacted. So there's less willingness to go out and leverage existing equity into new investment housing, and therefore you don't see the same impact coming from policy itself. In terms of our expectations for house prices going forward, we don't really expect that 2017 or 2018 will be a repeat of what we saw in 15. So back then, we had a macroprudential policy come in, and that had an impact. But equally, then the rate cuts that came thereafter actually then sort of supercharged the housing market again. You saw everything take off. We believe at the moment, because of what we're seeing with regards to the level of household debt, the more active approach they're taking to macroprudential policy, and equally sort of what we're also seeing in terms of changes of foreign investors as well, that we're not going to see that same repeat and acceleration in prices again. More than likely, in aggregate sense, we're talking about house price growth of something in the range of sort of 0 to 2%, or maybe in certain areas 0 to 5% sort of over the next couple of years. So that's much more in keeping with the income growth that we have been seeing in the economy, and also will be very much well received by the RBA and also APRA in terms of being consistent with maintaining financial stability and system stability in that sense. In terms of what I was mentioning there with foreign buyers, this has been something that hasn't necessarily been talked about as much. You see a lot of anecdotal comments about it, but the data at hand is quite difficult to sort of really get into. And so we don't really sort of talk about it in terms of particular percentages, but the shift down in foreign demand has been very, very significant. And what's probably important to note here is it's not so much about what the state governments have done in terms of increasing stamp duty or sort of any other developments there, but rather what's actually been done in China. So there was a speech by Jonathan Kearns, who's the head of financial stability from the RBA, a few weeks ago. And in that, he noted that about 10 to 15% of new dwellings are purchased by foreigners, based on the data they had to hand. Of those, about 75% were from China. Now, obviously, 3/4 of the population of buyers coming through are from one particular country. When said country decides to actually ban its citizens from taking money offshore to invest in foreign residential property, it has a pretty significant impact. And so this data is actually quite dated, and we would think that it's actually continuing on from there. But it really does emphasise that momentum we were getting from the foreign buyer is really gone. And it's really the housing market's going to be dictated by the domestic buyers going forward. That's not to say that population growth won't lead to support for the housing market. That's still going to be the case, but it's going to be for people who have permanent residency or at least a long-term temporary residency who are going to be sort of supporting the demand for property, both in terms of rental as well as owning and occupying. So that sort of is quite a different scenario, and again, supports why we believe that house prices are not going to be growing at such a rapid clip going forward. Now, the other part to note about sort of what we're seeing with the housing market is really around residential investment. So this has been quite a significant positive for the Australian economy for a number of years, contributing quite materially to growth. So here, and you can see in 2016, that added the maroon bar at the top, added about 0.4 percentage points to GDP. effectively, because of the strong demand we've seen from investors and also from the overseas buyers up until now, that really drove a significant amount of new dwelling construction across the capital cities, but particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. And that really did provide that the contribution of growth. But we are very much past that peak. We saw that in GDP, and we've also seen in dwelling approvals that we are now seeing a decline in residential investment, and that will continue going forward. So the part of the issue here is that we need to find a new source of investment for the economy. And pleasingly, we have started to see some offsets. So public investment, again, sort of being driven by the growth we're seeing in the population and also what's been happening in the housing market, because that provides quite a significant amount of tax receipts to the government. Those two forces have led them to actually think about a lot of new investment in new public infrastructure. So whether it be the light rail in Sydney, new roads in Melbourne, Metro in Melbourne, all these kind of, I guess, different sort of trains and rails systems, which have meant that we're trying to, I guess, get a better situation with the economy, sort of link our major capital cities better together, and then we can actually continue to develop and look after a larger population going forward. And it's very much welcome, albeit perhaps a bit of an annoyance to everyone who's trying to get around Sydney at the moment. So that's been a significant positive, and that will continue going forward. A lot of these projects run throughout the mid-2020s, and they will continue to add jobs and also activities through that time period. What we've also needed to hope to see is around business investment and getting more of a resurgence there. And here there's been quite, I guess, a mixed outcome. So we have seen a number of sectors which are more tied to sort of, I guess, foreign demand, look to try and increase supply. So those, I guess, around Sydney who are in the room will know that we've seen a very significant increase in construction of new hotels and those kind of things around Sydney, which we haven't seen really since the Olympics. So that increase in supply has been very much needed and has really come through with force. But in contrast to that, we haven't really seen the same level of activity coming through in some of the other major cities. And equally, across the nation, we haven't seen businesses be willing to actually invest in new equipment. So they're only really willing to actually go out and spend on new capacity if it actually is known to actually be demanded immediately. The uncertainty that remains around the overall economy, particularly around the consumer, has meant they're holding back in other areas. To actually see business investment not only offset the sort of the marginal sort of drag of not on residential investment, but also sort of support growth going forward, we really need to see business investment continue to accelerate, and we just don't have enough evidence of that being there at the moment. There is, I guess, justification if we think about the growth of tourism and education that's coming from Asia. There is justification for more of that development to happen going forward. But it really takes time to come through and actually really support the economy. Another way to kind of highlight sort of the mixed conditions that we have with regards to business investment is to think about sort of what's happening with business conditions across the sectors. And this is just, again, to emphasise that we are seeing very mixed conditions across the nation. So that the goods-related areas, so that's actually everything from construction and manufacturing, they're performing very well. So they're benefiting from the low Australian dollar, and that's being key support there, but as you can see, the consumer side is still remaining quite weak, and if we continue to see the outcomes we have seen with regards to GDP and the consumer, then it's difficult to actually really see a lot of these businesses actually want to actually go out and invest. For the retail space in particular, obviously the new entrance of Amazon, in addition to all the other foreign retailers, gives the kind of incumbent people in that sector more of a reason to sort of hold back and just kind of assess conditions in terms of thinking about their new investment in sort of real assets. That being said, they might look to actually go out and invest more in terms of their online capacity to try and sort of counter sort of the rise of Amazon. And we'll have to sort of wait and see how that sort of plays through. So the other thing I just wanted to talk about before we come back to the Australian dollar is really around sort of what we're seeing in terms of, I guess, global financial stability and the expectations of investors and also other economic agents. What we've seen, I guess, over the last kind of 5 or so years has been equity markets really relate very strongly to what's been happening with alternative easing around the world. Now, you can see very clearly here that there's been a very strong relationship between S&P 500 and also what the Fed balance sheet has done. That's now shifting because the Fed's balance sheet is actually coming back. But we still are seeing accommodation coming from the Bank of Japan and also from the ECB. So there is still more liquidity coming into the system and being a support. What was,
What was quite important about 2016 was that there was quite a significant shift in terms of people's expectations about what part of policy would actually drive growth going forward. And we moved from monetary policy through to thinking more about fiscal policy, which has really been kind of, I guess, the backwater of policy for quite a long period of time. Trump's rise to the presidency was really, I guess, the catalyst for this, him coming in and talking about massive infrastructure and tax reform and those kind of things. Was the starting point, but then the Macron coming through in France, and I guess for a time, a more positive sort of broader economic environment in Europe, really added to this idea that fiscal policy would be able to support growth going forward, it would drive efficiency, drive productivity, and hopefully then drive incomes as well, which would feed through to stronger consumption and investment growth as well. Now, what's important to us to note about this, I suppose, is that over about a year since Trump has been put into power, we haven't really seen any real economic impacts of this. So we've still seen a lot more talk going on in Washington, and that continues at the moment without really any sort of success at moving forward. And it is getting to the point now where equity markets are probably sort of hopeful, but equally they want to see this actually come through and provide evidence of support for the economy. And we need to see that going forward if we are to justify the current sort of levels of equity markets as they stand. And so this is kind of a bit of a risk factor, one that pertains both to sort of household wealth, but also just kind of the overall stability of the financial system, that we are kind of in an uncertain time on that sense. Our sort of base expectations around the US at the moment is that they will sort of get tax reform through, but it's not likely to provide a significant impact to the real economy there. And so they're likely to see a continuation of sort of growth around that sort of 2% figure, which is strong enough to see the FOMC continue on with their rate hikes, but at a very measured pace, similar to what we've seen over the last couple of years. So the implications of that for the Australian dollar is that we should see our currency come down from where it currently resides, about sort of 76 or 75, down to about sort of 70 by the end of next year and 68 in 2019. So interest rate differentials with the US are a very major part of that. And the other sort of major factor there is commodity prices. So on the commodity price front for Australia, there's two sort of major factors, being iron ore and coal. They're sort of the main areas which we receive most of our mining receipts from. It has been the case, I think we've been pleasantly surprised with the iron ore price, that it has been able to sustain a much higher level than we thought it would. There was times where we have been forecasting it to come down sort of to the high 40s or around 50. Instead, it's managed to stay in the 60s and 70s, or indeed a bit higher than that for most of this year. And what's also important to note about the benefit we receive from the iron ore is that because we are a very high quality producer, we actually get, I guess, first demand from the rest of the world. And particularly now we're seeing China move into a much more sort of, I guess, a quality of growth phase rather than a quantity of growth phase. They're looking for highest quality commodities that they can bring into the country, which have the least impact on the environment, and also allow them to make the best quality products to not only use in the domestic economy, but export as well. So, whereas the price of lower grade iron ore has fallen quite considerably, the price of what we produce has actually remained at quite an elevated level, has meant we've had that income flowing to Australia, which benefits not only the companies that export it, but equally sort of the people who work in the industry, as well as also the government as well. For coking coal, it's a little bit different. We don't necessarily have that same quality differential, and so we are beholden more to the market price. And we have had a number of supply shocks and limitations, which have meant prices are much higher than we thought they would have been. But it is our expectation that will drift away over the next sort of year or 18 months. The consequence of that should be a further weight on the currency, which again sort of justifies sort of where we sort of think the Australian dollar will go, down to sort of 70 or so. A bit further than that. Other sort of commodities that are important, oil we're not really a major exporter of, but LNG we are, and the oil price matters there. And again, that has been, I guess, a more of an upside surprise than we had expected, which also gives a little bit more support as well. So there are sort of, I guess, risks around sort of the profile, and that might see the Australian dollar hold up more than we have been expecting. But equally, it should actually sort of sort itself out and supply come online to actually lead to that lower Australian dollar. Just getting back to, I guess, to the rates front. Now, the benefit, I suppose, of the US continuing to raise rates is that the RBA should therefore be able to comfortably remain on hold and rely on that sort of rising rate differential to actually see the Australian dollar fall and its price provide support to the economy. We haven't really seen a lot of instances where we've had a negative interest rate differential with the US in the past, but we are pretty confident that this will be one of those. So basically, our expectation around the Fed is two more hikes after the December decision, which will be released next week, and that would see their Fed funds rate at 1.875% versus the cash rate at 1.5% here. So that would see a differential of about minus 38 on the cash rate. That should actually also lead to a lower term interest rates as well, in terms of lower differential for the term rates, which is a major factor in terms of thinking about foreign investors, thinking about whether they're wanting to actually provide their capital to us to invest or thinking about investing in offshore. We're now in a situation, well, we're expecting a situation basically where the US 10-year will be equivalent to the Australian 10-year. And so if you expect a situation like that to continue, plus you've got an expectation that the US dollar should rise where the Australian dollar should fall, that should mean that that marginal sort of flow of investment has actually moved to the US rather than us, which should see the Australian dollar fall until a point where the FX differential actually means that they will look to invest here instead. And so that really is a key positive for us in the sense that if we do see the Australian dollar fall down to 70 or a bit below, we actually get that sort of significant boost to our not so much the commodity exports, but around services sector, improved competitiveness, which will actually provide greater jobs, greater investment, and actually benefit the economy, albeit making holidays overseas a bit more expensive. So that's really what we're hoping to see, and indeed what the RBA is hoping to see as well, going forward over the next kind of 18 months. If that wasn't the case and the Australian dollar held up, then we might be in a situation where the RBA has to really think about its standing in terms of rates on hold. So they would therefore sort of shift from their optimistic bias to a neutral bias and then potentially think about sort of noting that a willingness to actually cut rates going forward if conditions did need that to be the case. So overall, just before we start with Q&A, I just want to emphasise that we have seen a very significant shift in terms of how central banks are looking to operate in the world. We've seen the rise of macroprudential policy as, a complement to what we've seen in terms of the changes in the base sort of benchmark rates, and equally this need to try and drive confidence in growth and activity and productivity in the economy rather than trying to fight inflation. And it is our expectation that this will need to continue on over the next couple of years at least, because we just don't really believe that inflation is going to make that comeback that people have been expecting for a long time. Wages are very central to this, as are sort of broader expectations around family finances. And there we have quite significant concerns around the Australian consumer's willingness to go out and spend and that ability to of that sector to drive growth going forward. In contrast to that, we do see positives coming from business investment, which should be enough to offset the decline we're seeing in res investment and hopefully add a little bit more to growth. But the total consequence of all of those factors is that we should see growth below trend in 2018 and 2019, which would see the RBA remaining firmly on hold, albeit sort of potentially shifting from thinking about having a tightening bias to having an easing bias if that is needed to be. In terms of the global environment, we just kind of are in a watch and see sort of situation. If we do see the changes in fiscal policy come through and provide support to the real economy, then the equity market valuations will be justified. But equally, if we don't see that come through, then we might see further volatility come through there, and that would be a further risk to the consumer and household wealth. And with that, I'll leave it for questions.
Thanks, Elliot. I don't know about everyone else, I love listening to a good economist talk. There's never any shortage of data. It's always evidence-based, and I think we as actuaries could sort of learn a lot from the way the economists sort of present their stories and their outlook. Before I the same format. If anyone's got any questions, put your hand up and announce yourself. But the big question for me at the moment, Elliot, is what's happening with Bitcoin? It just seems to have gone out of control, and I'm just wondering whether I've missed the chance to buy in or not.
It's definitely not an asset we actually track, let alone forecast, I suppose. But look, it is the whole cryptocurrency space is an interesting one, and it probably really emphasises people's not only people's desire to try and find an asset which will actually give them growth in wealth going forward, but equally to find an alternative to sort of what has been the investable universe going forward. I suppose if you want to take a more, I guess, call it a negative or concerning view, it does maybe raise questions about people's confidence in sort of the existing currency market and sort of fiat currency in general. But I think more than likely it's just a situation where you've got this kind of new asset, and I generally regard it as kind of more of a financial asset than a currency, that people are looking to use as an alternative investment, and because of its size being so small that it can very quickly rise up. But I don't necessarily think it's going to become sort of a very established asset base by any means, nor all the other cryptocurrencies. So, yeah, look, it's interesting to see sort of the psychology at play, but it doesn't really form a particular meaningful part of our sort of forecast, so to speak.
Thanks, Elliot. Now, it was a question in jest, really, but it does go to the point that, when I look at things now, what are the asset classes to invest in? Everything seems to be a little bit toppy. Is there any asset classes that you think are a little underdone at the moment?
I'm an economist rather than a equity strategist, but look, I think one of my major areas is covering Asia, and I think I'm a very strong believer in, I guess, the structural growth story that we see there, and I would note that the focus of most global managers generally being to invest into the US, whether it be tech or sort of other parts of that economy, so there probably is a lot of opportunity to come through as Asia, so China, India, and the rest of the region develop, and actually see more money sort of flow into those sectors. And a further, I guess, reason as to why that might actually come through in the future is we're starting to see a shift from the US into Europe, being sort of again driven by this kind of sort of opportunities that might come from an area which has had softer growth going forward, softer growth in the past, and has been underinvested in. Equally, albeit with a very different economic situation, I think Asia has been underinvested in as well, and there is probably a lot of opportunity there.
Okay, thanks. So, look, any questions?
Just following on from that Bitcoin comment, I think considering Bitcoin as an asset will come along with its acceptance to pay for things. And given that acceptance has been really lagging its price growth, I feel somewhat concerning, and I wanted to ask whether that was something that concerns you as well. And as a follow-on, I think also just in the rise of sort of open banking and decentralization of financial markets and taking out sort of clearinghouses and stuff like that, do you think that regulation has really kept up with all of that? And do you think that really poses some risk to economic stability overall?
That's a big question. Look, I think what we've sort of seen with Bitcoin in particular is there is the need for that regulation and trying to work out how to actually fit it into the system. So that comes through on the implications for tax as well as it does for ability to pay. It's been quite interesting to see that a lot of the central banks around the world have been really starting to think about what digital currencies might mean for the system, with a few countries around the world, a few central banks around the world thinking about actually adopting a digital currency which would run alongside their existing one. Now, there are then implications kind of for the banking system if you suddenly have a new entrant who can actually provide deposit capacity. And it's the same with other people like Alibaba and people like that who would take deposits. If the sort of population base has confidence in them, then it can definitely be there. But it does mean that we're going to have to really think about trying to make sure that each part of these new systems that there are integrated into the bigger whole of the banking system, to make sure that we don't sort of see any issues with sort of liquidity moving from one sector to the other and leaving the other sort of dry, so to speak. And I think, acceptance with regards to using it as a payment system, I mean, we are in a very different situation now that we've already done a lot of the hard work in terms of moving to from just sort of credit cards and cash to being able to use various devices for payment. So it's probably not that big a step to switch from sort of paying through Apple Pay from a credit card to paying through Alipay or some sort of digital currency that sits through an app on your phone.
I forgot to introduce myself, so Pooja Nagarajan from CBA. Thank you very much.
Eric Ransom. You talked about the importance of fiscal policy to asset pricing, or equities in particular. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about how the Western government sort of deficits work themselves out over time, and whether there's any kind of threats. I presume they're largely funded by our Asian friends.
Yeah, I mean, from all the talk that we've seen in the last few years, there doesn't seem to be a particular concern about sort of the trajectory of debt. So, I mean, as an example, the US situation, the focus has very much been on the driver, or it driving growth as opposed to driving the debt levels. The reality is that the developed world is rapidly aging, and you probably argue a lot of Asia, particularly China, is rapidly aging as well. So we do need to keep that in mind, because we will progressively over the next decade or so move to a situation where people are willing to invest to actually drawing down on their assets. And I think it does concern me that we are getting a situation that there's probably not a good balance there, and there's not really a way to actually rein these deficits in. It doesn't mean they're going to sort of go spiraling higher, but they're going to be that kind of continual weight on the economy. And it also means that the more fiscal debt you have, the greater or the less ability you have to actually react to a crisis if it happens. And so that is an additional concern. It means that we're kind of losing another sort of instrument to actually try and right the economy and drive growth going forward.
We've got a related question on this, Elliot, over the webinar from Raymond Yan. Will the increasing US budget deficit act as a counterforce to the falling Aussie dollar?
I think this falling Australian dollar would be sort of more the consequence of kind of expectations of that growth. But you probably think, while it's a negative Australian dollar in the near term in terms of the reform that's been there and the potential higher growth, if you take a 5-year view, then generally you probably think the US economy is probably actually weaker because of the growth being pulled forward. And so that would actually support the Australian dollar and therefore actually be a detractor for growth here. So it definitely, it's not so much, I guess, a concern in the near term. It's probably more of a positive, but as we move further out, it's potentially going to be negative there.
Yep. Thank you. Any more questions?
Hi, Paul Rahill again from ANZ Wealth. Elliot, what do you think about like the Internet of Everything in terms of its impact on both competition in the goods market and also wages, leading to more offshoring of jobs and domestic competition in terms of the labour market, in terms of both inflation going forward over the longer term and both wage growth going forward? Thank you.
So I mean, if we start with inflation overall, obviously sort of this kind of greater sort of online sort of marketplaces and greater supply there does really generally sort of suggest that we'll see weaker inflation going forward. And because of the drive for efficiency that's behind those marketplaces, so Amazon, all those kind of entrants, you can probably quite easily argue that you see further weight on wages growth as well. And it probably does also push more of an efficiency drive across the broader economy as well, which I think is probably what we're seeing across not only the retail space, but the broader economy as well. So all that sort of suggests, lower inflation and lower lower inflation, lower wages growth as well. The question where you get to, I suppose, at that point is that a lot of the people, a lot of the incumbent retailers that are actually doing the employing may actually then sort of push towards these kind of marketplaces as well, which means you might actually start to lose those jobs, which is obviously a significant negative for incomes. And it does definitely sort of push towards more of the, offshoring, but also just the use of robots and all those kind of things, very efficient sort of distribution practices, which are not necessarily going to actually provide jobs and incomes for Australia going forward. So it is, I think it's a negative for both those factors.
And look, there's just one more question, Elliot, from the webinar. How do you read the surprisingly positive retail data that came out at the beginning of the week?
So it does come after three very weak outcomes. So you had two declines and a flat outcome. Equally, I think it would have been around about the same time that you also saw sort of higher oil price as well. So I think it's definitely positive, I suppose, that we saw an above expectation sprint. But because we're coming after that weakness, I wouldn't be seeing it as, a resurgent consumer, more so just kind of a pop after a period of weakness.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Well, thanks for your time, Elliot, and thanks for a fantastic presentation. If everyone can just join me in congratulating Elliot. Thank you.